During the 1990s, at the urging of politicians and pundits, Americans became accustomed to thinking of their country as the indispensable nation. Indispensability carried with it both responsibilities and prerogatives. The chief responsibility was to preside over a grand project of political economic convergence and integration, commonly referred to as globalization. In point of fact, however, globalization served as a euphemism for soft or informal empire. The collapse of the Soviet Union appeared to offer an opportunity to expand and perpetuate that empire, creating something akin to a global Pax Americana. The indispensable nation's chief prerogative, self-assigned, was to establish and enforce the norms governing the post-Cold War international order. Even in the best of circumstances, imperial policing is a demanding task, requiring not only considerable acumen, but also an abundance of determination. The preferred American approach was to rely, whenever possible, on suasion. Yet, if pressed, Washington did not hesitate to use force, as its numerous military adventures during the 1990s demonstrated. Whatever means were employed, the management of empire assumed the existence of bountiful reserves of power, economic, political, cultural, but above all, military. In the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, few questioned that assumption. The status of the United States as sole superpower appeared unassailable. Its dominance was unquestioned and unambiguous. This was not hyper-nationalistic chest-thumping, it was the conventional wisdom. Recalling how Washington saw the post-Cold War world and America's place in or atop it helps us understand why policymakers failed to anticipate, deter, or deflect the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. A political elite preoccupied with the governance of empire paid little attention to protecting the United States itself. In practical terms, prior to 9/11, the mission of Homeland Defense was unassigned. The institution nominally referred to as the Department of Defense didn't actually do defense. It specialized in power projection. In 2001, the Pentagon was prepared for any number of contingencies in the Balkans or Northeast Asia or the Persian Gulf. It was just not prepared to address threats to the nation's eastern seaboard. Well-trained and equipped U.S. forces stood ready to defend Seoul or Riyadh. Manhattan was left to fend for itself. Odd as they may seem, these priorities reflected a core principle of national security policy. When it came to defending vital American interests, asserting control over the imperial periphery took precedence over guarding the nation's own perimeter. After 9/11, the Bush administration affirmed this core principle. Although it cobbled together a new agency to attend to homeland security, the administration also redoubled its efforts to shore up the Pax Americana and charged the Department of Defense with focusing on this task. This meant using any means necessary, suasion where possible, force as required, to bring the Islamic world into conformity with prescribed American norms. Rather than soft and consensual, the approach to imperial governance became harder and more coercive. So for the United States, after 9/11, war became a seemingly permanent condition. President George W. Bush and members of his administration outlined a campaign against terror that they suggested might last decades, if not longer. On the national political scene, few questioned that prospect. In the Pentagon, senior military officers spoke in terms of generational war lasting up to a century. Just 2 weeks after 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was already instructing Americans to forget about exit strategies. We're looking at a sustained engagement that carries no deadlines. By and large, Americans were slow to grasp the implications of a global war with no exits and no deadlines. To earlier generations, place names like Iraq and Afghanistan had been synonymous with European rashness, the sort of obscure and unwelcoming jurisdictions to which overly ambitious kings and slightly mad adventurers might repair to squabble. For the present generation, it has already become part of the natural order of things that GIs should be exerting themselves at great cost to pacify such far-off domains. For the average American tuning into the nightly news, reports of U.S. casualties incurred in distant lands now seem hardly more out of the ordinary than reports of partisan shenanigans on Capitol Hill or brush fires raging out of control in Southern California. How exactly did the end of the long peace so quickly yield the long war? Seeing themselves as a peaceful people, Americans remain wedded to the conviction that the conflicts in which they find themselves embroiled are not of their own making. The global war on terror is no exception. Certain of our own benign intentions, we reflexively assign responsibility for war to others. Typically malignant Hitler-like figures, inexplicably bent on denying us the peace that is our fondest wish. This book challenges that supposition. It argues that the actions of Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, however malevolent, cannot explain why the United States today finds itself enmeshed in seemingly never-ending conflict.